Okay, welcome to class. Thanks for braving the rain and stuff to be here. And so, any questions? No questions. Oh, I want to hand out this brochure that Ralph Hotchkiss failed to bring to class last week about the Whirlwind wheelchair. And I have on the website a link to the PBS NewsHour interview that was broadcast on that day, and it's 5.5 minutes, so check that out. It's real good. One thing that Ralph mentioned was he referred to people as wheelchair riders, and that sort of got me thinking, because I've been using the term wheelchair users, and I was trying to figure out why he had a different way of talking about things. And so I tried to see what Google had as far as images of wheelchair users and wheelchair riders. And I also came up on this image as well, which shows wheelchair as a passenger. So the question I had in my mind is, Is one term users versus riders? What's the difference? Is one more active than another? What's the different connotations of one terminology versus the other? And maybe how do you refer to yourself when you talk about yourself?
I refer to myself as a wheelchair user.
Wheelchair user.
I have never heard anyone say wheelchair rider before.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
did you think it's?
I frankly didn't notice.
Oh. Okay, I did. Dara, how about you?
Well, I've heard wheelchair users, but not wheelchair riders before, so I kind of go with the Jonas point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's how you refer, you know, to your use of a wheelchair when you talk to other people.
Yeah.
Okay. Why would a wheelchair rider be different? Would it be a more positive term than wheelchair user? And what sort of connotations, you know, would it have, do you think?
I've never heard people refer to being wheelchair riders, but riders seem to imply
passive
you have a
thing.
Choice, kind of.
Yeah.
So in that way it's more active?
Well, I was thinking about, you're riding a horse, and the horse is doing all the work. And so I'm not sure it's a more active term or a more positive term in my mind. I think it's just a different term. And maybe it causes a little bit of confusion, or maybe it causes a little bit of thought, but that's what came into my mind. And then there's this whole thing about, you know, you're a rider in a car, you know, you're a passenger in a car, and that's what, you know, this image sort of brings up. So that's another thing. Okay, every once in a while you're asked, you know, what have you been doing? And so you either have to write down or say what you've been doing. And that couldn't take many forms. You may be asked to write a book or a book chapter. You might be asked to write a proposal asking for money. You may have to write a journal article. You might, if you're working on a project, you have to write a project report. You may have to do a presentation, and it may be a PowerPoint presentation or a poster presentation. And there's this thing called elevator pitch, which I'll get into on the next slide. And then sometimes you just have to write an abstract. And I found a real good webpage on how to write an abstract, because Dara, you know, brought that to my attention. She had some questions. And a lot of times you don't have time to really give a full-blown explanation about what you're doing or what you're working on. You may only have time for one breath, or may only have time for one phrase, not even a whole sentence. You know, I remember when I was in Ted Kennedy's office, you know, I was nervous and stuff, and I was trying to explain, you know, who I was, and so I had to do that in a very short amount of time. So, you need to keep in mind, you know, how to, you know, do this, because you're going to have to report to, you know, your boss or your parents or your spouse or your boyfriend, girlfriend, or roommate or something, because they're going to ask you questions about things. And so it's good to sort of organize what you're going to say. And let's focus on elevator pitch. An elevator pitch is supposed to be like maybe a 3-minute presentation where you've met somebody in the elevator and you're pitching your project to them. You're trying to interest them. And I saw this on the web, and it sounded sort of interesting. So the elements of an elevator pitch are: you're going to talk about, you know, who you're targeting, and what is the need, and what you're doing. You know, the name of the product, and what kind of product is it, and what is the key benefit or the compelling reason to buy it or use it, or you know, whatever, or if it's an activity, you know, the compelling reason to do that activity, and then you want to sometimes contrast that with you want to talk about, you know, why this is different. Oh, this was so great because this conference was so good, or this concert was so good because, and then you also would have maybe a statement of that would contrast it with something ordinary or some other thing. So this is the example they gave for Fortune 500 companies who are looking to cut costs. So that's the target customers, and who operate in data centers. Amdahl's computers are plug compatible, so that's the product. That match or surpass IBM computers, that's the comparison, and features and performance at a far more attractive price, and that's a compelling reason to buy. Then they're saying, unlike Hitachi's line of computers, so that's the contrast or differentiation, our product have been backed by the same service and support for over 20 years. So that's an experience-based thing. So you can adapt this kind of pitch for, you know, whatever it is. And it also makes a good starting statement for an oral presentation, because you get everything in a short space. And like I said, it prepares the audience's mind for what's going to come next. But, you know, in this case, it stands alone. It's something like an abstract, but it could be followed by a more detailed presentation. Wayne?
Dave, I would just add to that. I had an engineer at work, and he used to correct me. I can't say that we need to give a unique way of phrasing it. I just have to tell you what he said.
Okay.
Basically, whenever I would go to him and say, hey, we need, like, an executive summary on this.
Right.
And the statement would be, well, you know, we need it, like, in a hurry kind of thing. And he would say, well, that's going to take me a day or two. If you run 10 or 15 pages, I can do that in a couple of hours.
Right.
Because he was saying, you know, I could really just write all this detail, but if you really want it concise and nice,
yep,
and compact, I've got to really think about that, and it's harder to do.
It is harder to do. It's harder to say things or present things in a smaller time frame, and it takes a lot of practice and talent. So, But an executive summary should not be very long, because, you know, executives get bored after one page. So you want to make it short. And an abstract is short too. It's typically a paragraph sized piece of writing. Okay. Well, I hope this, you know, will help you, because you're going to be, you know, typically you're asked to do something like this every now and then. So now you know how to do it, perhaps. And there's there'll be links on the I posted this already on the webpage, and there's a link here to this article. Okay. So my colleague found this Doonesbury cartoon from 2004, and I'm not a Doonesbury reader, so, you know, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. But this guy is BD, and sometimes he wears a helmet, and I guess he was... he's a soldier, and he got injured, and so his friend is saying, so what are you reading these days, soldier? Catalogs for prosthetic devices. It's amazing the advances they've made. There's this model with sensors that read leg strain 50 times a second, and then makes adjustments to the stride. And these things are now made of graphite and titanium, and loaded with built-in microprocessors. Here's one that costs almost $100,000. You're kidding. Well, that's with a DVD player and air conditioning. Man, you think that'd be standard. And this sort of brings up a couple things, you know. It brings to the point that, you know, there are advances being made in prosthetics, and all sorts of other areas in assistive technology. But a lot of times they are very expensive because they involve a lot of technology, or they're made in small quantities, and there's a limited market. But the problem is that they'll cost a lot of money for those reasons, and that sort of puts them out of the reach of most everybody. You think the VA would put up $100,000 to buy a prosthetic?
In terms of vehicle grants, yes, they would.
Yeah,
that's
so.
So. The adaptive equipment that the VA is providing is costing $100,000 at least. When you talk about driving adaptive equipment and van modifications.
So the VA is probably the only agency that would do that. But if you happen to have,
not in the real world.
If you happen to have the right insurance, you know, maybe they'd pay for it. Or if you find the right benefactor, or you're independently wealthy, then you can afford things like that. So you know, there's things out there, but there's, you know, that cost a lot of money. So on Thursday, I hope you can make it for Terry Adams. She was here last Thursday, right over here. She's the assistant director of the Stanford Disability Resource Center, and has been a contributor to the class for a long time. And this year, she's going to talk about something that's close in our political minds, healthcare. And she's going to talk about the intersection of healthcare with disability in the form of durable medical equipment. And I'm sure she'll have her own unique perspective on it. And I really hope you can attend that, because that'll be really good. But today, we have Ed Brode, and he's another colleague of mine from the VA. And he received his master's in health science in 1980 from San Jose State University. And he's been at the VA almost 30 years now, working in the Department of PM&R, primarily in the spinal cord injury unit as a kinesiotherapist. And in 83, he became the program manager of the driver evaluation program, and that program evaluates disabled veterans' ability to return to independent driving. In 1990, he was certified as a driver rehab specialist through the Association of Driver Rehabilitation Specialists and the Department of Veterans Affairs. In 2005, he co-authored a study, and I think I was on that as well, entitled Predictive Validity of Driving Simulator Assessments Following Traumatic Brain Injury. He currently teaches the annual VA Central Office Prosthetics course in driver evaluation. These are folks that are based nationally throughout the VA system who provide services to veterans in their area. And it's important that they know about driver assessment and driver training. But most of his work is with adaptive equipment prescribing and training veterans of various driving ability equipment, including mechanical hand controls, steering systems, and computer-based hand controls. And he has a van outside today that we can look at later on. So, yeah, well, we have umbrellas, and we're hardy people. So please give a warm welcome to Ed Brode.
Thank you.
Here, take the microphone, first of all.
Moving target.
Okay. Thank you.
Make you start your slides.
Thank you. First, I'd like to introduce Mark Samuel, sitting in the back. Mark is an occupational therapist. He's also a certified driver rehab specialist who works with us in the program, so he was able to join us today. My talk today is going to be in three parts. Obviously, it's going to be based on the VA model, since I've been with the VA close to 30 years. I've been doing driving evaluations for about 27 years now.
Where's this guy go, man?
You just put that on your belt. Or...
Okay.
So I've been doing the driving evaluations for approximately 27 years. The first two parts of my presentation, I want to explore real briefly the VA program, how it started. The second part will be mostly clinical assessments. My, by going into the clinical assessments, it's going to give us insights into what type of driving evaluations our vets might need. Obviously, we're talking about different disabilities from spinal cord injury to amputations to traumatic head injuries to neurological conditions. And then the third part will be actually getting into the adaptive equipment end of it in terms of driving adaptive equipment, van modifications, and high-tech driving systems. This didn't work out. Okay, so basically, the VA program started in 1974. It was mandated by Congress. At that particular time, there were 26 driver training centers established across the country. They were primarily established in spinal cord injury centers, because at that time, we were having a lot of Vietnam vets coming back. We still had a lot of Korean vets and World War II vets coming back and needed the service in terms of some type of driving adaptive equipment. Typically, it was just basic hand controls for paraplegics. So at that time, the technology out there was really just basic mechanical hand controls, and some vets were so inventive that they just started driving with canes, just using a cane for gas and brake. Physical medicine rehab therapists provide the service, and Mark and I are classified as certified driver rehab specialists. The VA has spent a lot of time and money in sending us to school and to educate us in terms of the specialized area. Palo Alto program was established in 1975. I'm going to be using some VA acronyms, but VISN 21, all that means really is that we cover all of Northern California, parts of Nevada, and some of the South Pacific. So veterans are referred to us from these outlying VAs coming to Palo Alto for their initial assessments, any type of evaluations and training. We do driving adaptive equipment. We do safe driving assessments now. As the veteran population is getting older and older, we're seeing a lot of neurological conditions in terms of stroke, in terms of Alzheimer's, some sorts of senile dementia. So the VA is very, very concerned in terms of safe driving, in terms of can these people still drive. And that's what Mark and I do. We do assessments in terms of determining cognitive, visual, perceptual types of things that are able to remain independent drivers. We also try and educate them in the DMV process. We've all gone through the DMV process, and we know what a black hole that can be. So that can be very time-consuming in trying to educate and trying to get our vets through the DMV process if their license has been suspended or revoked through some type of medical condition. We have the Driver Stimulation Training Center, and also we do some GPS training. Now, GPS training has mostly been focused on our polytrauma patients. Polytrauma is a term being used now for our returning Iraqi and Afghanistan vets, because we're seeing multiple types of injuries coming from blast injuries to the head associated with any type of physical deformities, and also a lot of underlying or overlying PTSD coming back now. There's a lot of PTSD coming back, so we're trying to sort out all these issues in terms of returning to independent driving. Any questions anybody has, just feel to... Okay, so sixth level program what we have here is driving adaptive equipment evaluations or vehicle modifications. So this will be the full-blown evaluation where we're working with someone, say, a spinal cord injured, was wheelchair bound, that's going to need some type of modified van, some type of driving adaptive equipment. As I mentioned before, we'll do safe driving assessments with or without adaptive equipment. So typically that would be for our vets that don't need any driving adaptive equipment, but I mentioned before, might have some other, you know, underlying neurological conditions such as a stroke or some type of a head injury. We can actually do follow-up driver training. As I mentioned before, the VA is not the real world, so we can spend as much time as we need to with a vet after doing an evaluation. They might need X amount of hours of driver training just to get them up to speed in terms of their safety and in terms of any DMV issues that they might need. Then, of course, we have the simulator training, and then, of course, the GPS training again. Okay, our referral process, in order for us to see a vet, has to be physician-generated consult. It's a prosthetic request. Prosthetic service is really in charge of the adaptive equipment program, but Mark and I are on the medical end of it, so we need physicians' referral to us in terms of what is the underlying you know, medical condition, the veteran being referred to us. A lot of times there can be multiple medical kinds of diagnoses. It could be a veteran request. A veteran or veteran family might feel they're not safe to drive, or they might need some type of driving adaptive equipment to help them remain independent drivers. And an interfacility consult just means that since it's a VISN 21 program, we're Northern California-wide, we're going to Nevada, so they would come out from outlying VAs. So Palo Alto is really the regional center for driver evaluation. We're also what's called a level one polytrauma center. There are four major polytrauma centers across the country, and Palo Alto is one of them, which means we're partnered up now with the Department of Defense. And so we get direct referrals from Walter Reed and Bethesda for active duty personnel coming into Palo Alto for training. So it's been a big change from the VA from before. Now we're seeing active duty, and that lays, you know, a whole layer of bureaucracy in terms of Department of Defense and VA. But it's working out pretty nicely now in terms of making sure none of these guys are falling through the cracks. Okay, as a certified driver rehab specialist, we have certain standards of practice that we have to follow. We do a clinic interview, which is just basically an interview of finding out past driving history, what problems they might be having driving, what's their DMV status, is a license valid or not valid. We would do an orientation to the vehicle based on what their physical disability would be. We would actually do a behind-the-wheel assessment based on that clinical assessment that we would be doing. We could do a behind-the-wheel functional in terms of the vehicle or adaptive equipment that they might need. The recommendations, again, for driver training, if any X amount of hours of driver training might be needed to bring them up to speed so they're safe to be operating either with or without adaptive equipment. We do the patient education in terms of educating them in terms of what type of adaptive equipment they're going to be needing or any type of a DMV process. And finally, we do a vehicle inspection. So if the VA is paying for any type of vehicle modifications, we will get into doing a vehicle inspection. So it's a pretty comprehensive program that we offer. It's very, very time-consuming. Some of our assessments can take up to 2 hours, 2.5 hours before we even get them on the road. So it's quite intensive in terms of the interview, in terms of the clinical assessment. Okay, the biggest question is, when can I resume driving? I mean, that's the biggest question. Obviously, we know as a society, driving is very, very important to all of us, and especially for anyone who's disabled, who's received a traumatic injury, they immediately want to get back on the road as soon as they can. So it's a big issue that we have to address. Okay, so our initial evaluation, we're looking at the different types of injury. For an SCI, which is a spinal cord injury, we typically like to wait anywhere from 4 to 12 months post-injury before we do an evaluation. That way it gives the spinal cord time to heal. They're able to go through all their physical, occupational, speech therapy if needed. They get stabilized in terms of the medication. We're looking at issues of spasticity in terms of their spasms they might be getting, in terms of what medications they might be taking for the spasticity. Traumatic brain injury can be closed or an open head injury. It can be anywhere up to 1 year post-injury, giving the brain time to heal. And so we're looking at those issues in terms of the healing of the brain and when that evaluation can take place. CVA or stroke, once again, would be like a head injury, basically up to 1 year. Depending on whatever visual perceptual problems they might have following the CVA. So we're looking at all those issues there. Multiple sclerosis will be needed as progression of the disease. As you know, MS is a progressive disease, so they have to be followed a little bit more closely, maybe with some follow-up evaluations and follow-up training, or maybe even added more adaptive equipment. Orthopedic would be pain-free, and we're looking at functional range of motion. We're looking at strength in terms of, you know, obviously being able to turn a steering wheel, operate gas brake, operate key usage, secondary usage. Neuro would be seizure-free up to 6 months. That would be related mostly to any type of a brain injury or major stroke. And then obviously they would have to be medically stable. Okay, so getting back to our clinic interview again, we're going over driving history, we're going over the DMV status, vehicle status, what kind of vehicle do they have, can that particular vehicle be modified, is it appropriate for the level of disability that they might have, are they going to be a driver or a non-driver. A good portion of the vets that we see aren't drivers, so we would prescribe some type of an attendant vehicle for a caregiver or a spouse to drive. So we're looking at all those issues. And then the type of an evaluation, is it going to be in a van or a sedan? And all that will be based in the clinic in terms of looking at their medical records and looking at the clinical interview and evaluation that we've done. Orientation to the vehicle. So once we do our interview and our assessment, we're looking at either it's going to be either a van or a sedan type of an evaluation. We're looking at the types of adaptive equipment they might be needing in terms of what type of hand controls. It might be some type of a left-footed gas pedal. Big thing is that we're looking at transfer skills in terms of what's their functional skills if they're in a wheelchair. Can they transfer independently? Do they need maximum assist? Are the wheelchair skills good? Are they safe with the wheelchair skills? We're looking at if they're going to be a driver, are they going to be a wheelchair driver, or are they going to be transferring from the wheelchair to a driver's seat? Of course, that would apply mainly to a van. If they're driving from a sedan, we're looking at if their ability to transfer into the vehicle and do something with that manual wheelchair. Are they able to load that wheelchair independently? So the whole philosophy of the program is to make them totally independent if they're going to be a driver. So either with a power wheelchair, which would necessitate some type of van or a van modification, or if it's a manual wheelchair, if they still want to be driving a sedan, can they transfer into that sedan independently and safely and still have some type of wheelchair storage issues where they have to do that independently? And then safe vehicle ingress, egress. This will basically be in terms of getting on the wheelchair lift or the wheelchair ramp safely, operating that lift or ramp, and getting into the van safely. Okay, behind the wheel assessment is now, after everything is the interview, the assessment is taken care of in the clinic, we're going to take them out on the road in the appropriate vehicle that we decide what vehicle is going to work and what type of driving adaptive equipment is going to work. We're fortunate that we have five different vehicles that we use with different types of driving adaptive equipment, so we can configure that vehicle to that particular disability. So once again, we can get in that vehicle, we can change out the type of adaptive equipment. If they're going to be a wheelchair driver or a transfer, then we can actually take out that driver's seat and place a wheelchair in that driver's station so we can just give them the assessment behind the wheel. Because the biggest component of the program is actually getting them on the road and see how they do in terms of an actual driving environment with the driving adaptive equipment that Mark and I feel that they can use. Of course, then we're looking at overall driving skills. We're looking at overall functional skills while in the vehicle. And then they're assessed on a comprehensive driving course, and it's going to start out on the residential, start out in the hospital grounds, progress to residential, go to complex, commercial, expressway, freeway, and finally mountain driving. So it's about a 7 or 8 step process in terms of getting them out in all different types of driving scenarios to make sure that they're safe and they're able to operate with those hand controls. This initial assessment is also going to, once again, give us an idea in terms of how many hours of behind-the-wheel training they might need. Because we just can't release them and say, here you go with the new adaptive equipment and expect them to perform well on public roads because there's a safety issue concerned on that. So the behind-the-wheel functional, we're looking at body position and awareness problems, particularly if they're spinal cord injured or they have some type of weak upper extremity or upper torso balance issues. So we're looking at different belting systems for upper torso. If you're driving from a wheelchair, it's a lot different than driving from a factory seat because your balance is compromised. The wheelchair, even though the wheelchair is secured into a power lockdown system, there still is going to be movement in terms of the dynamics of the van, in terms of making right and left-hand turns, quick stops, fast stops. If you're on a hill, if you're driving in San Francisco, you can imagine the angle of the hill. You know that well, huh? And so that can change the dynamics of the whole driving safety of accessing any side type of hand controls. Anyone that has any type of proprioception difficulty in terms of lack of sensation in the lower extremities, or even upper extremities, we're looking at accurate foot placement on the pedals. So someone who has any type of diabetic or any type of neuropathy that can't feel their lower extremities and are still using a gas brake, countless times you're going to hear that they're getting their foot caught underneath the gas pedal or caught underneath the brake and they can't feel their foot and they don't know what they're doing. So that's a big issue in terms of figuring out if this is really going to be a safety concern. If that is, then of course you definitely would have to move to some type of a hand control. Difficulty moving from gas to brake, once again, could be a coordination problem or it could be a proprioception problem. Decreased accuracy with steering, that could be a visual spatial issue in terms of some type of a stroke or a traumatic brain injury where they're not seeing the exact right driving scene correctly in terms of where they are in terms of their lane placement, making left and right hand turns. Of course, we're looking at muscular strength. Muscular strength to operate the steering wheel. Muscular strength to operate either gas brake with their foot or with hand controls. Once again, we're looking at coordination and dexterity. We're looking at range of motion. Is a person able to make a complete turn around the steering wheel with one hand or with both arms? And there's some issues going on in terms of upper extremity and even lower extremity range of motion where it's decreased. And then, of course, we're looking at endurance in terms of driving for any type of long distance. So someone who has a thermoregulatory condition like multiple sclerosis who doesn't do very well in the heat, if they're driving in the heat of the day, then their endurance is definitely going to be compromised in terms of driving safety and the ability to operate any type of driving controls. Okay, recommendations. So based after our initial clinical assessment, our interview, and our behind-the-wheel assessment for the first time, we're looking at any type of driving lessons that might be appropriate and the recommended driving adaptive equipment. We're going to be looking at the vehicle modifications, and driving adaptive equipment, which would be routed to our prosthetic service, who would be the ones that would make the approval on the driving adaptive equipment. There are private vendors that are involved. There's a whole slew of private vendors out there that do these modifications and install all the driving adaptive equipment. And what Mark and I do is that we educate the vets in terms of what vendors are best to use in terms of whatever driving adaptive equipment they might need. It might be a high-tech driving system, so there's only certain vendors that can do that, and also for any type of a vehicle modification. And then for the VA end of it, we enter progress notes. That is a medical note of the record that has documented everything that we did, all the driving adaptive equipment that they're going to be requiring. Any questions so far or comments? Okay, then finally we do a patient education. We educate the patient on the vendor selection, the vehicle purchase, final driving goals, how many hours it might take for driver training, adaptive equipment, and then there's education in terms of the veteran caregiver educated in the proper use of adaptive equipment. Particularly on wheelchair lifts and van modifications, it's very, very important that we're educated in safety because a lot of accidents can happen. A lot of people have been injured. And unfortunately, some deaths have occurred from people using wheelchair lifts inappropriately and just not belting down a person correctly in a vehicle when that vehicle is in motion. And then finally, we go to a vehicle inspection. So once a vehicle is completed by the vendor, we're going to inspect that vehicle to ensure that all the driving adaptive equipment has been installed per the regular prescription. Any follow-up driver training, again, would be scheduled, and that would be taken care of in terms of training the veteran in his completed van. And then any adaptive equipment problems can be resolved at that time. I can tell you that any time we're dealing with any type of a high-tech van, There's always going to be issues in terms of ergonomic placement in the driving compartment where all the different controls have to go. And some of my later slides will show you exactly the fit is very, very important. And I think some of you might have seen our driver simulation stations that we have at the VA. There's two stations that we have now, one a regular cab and one with hand controls. And basically, the simulation stations are going to mimic the road performance that we do out in the community. And Dave helped with that, right, Dave? Doing on that. We're able to record driving deficits. So we can do multitasking on the simulator in terms of seeing if they're able to pick up things in the periphery in terms of a icon might flash on an outer screen of a horn, and they would have to see that horn while they're staring down the road and hit a particular button to see that they saw that horn. We're tracking overall driving skills, and we have the ability to place hazards in the driving environment. So a lot of times we'll have pedestrians cross out in the middle of the road, a ball roll out in the middle of the road, and see what type of gas to brake reaction time they have, or any type of evasive maneuvers they might be taking, or any other inappropriate behaviors. We're looking at vehicle speed and any type of crash results that might be occurring, and it's all recorded for us. And this gives you a shot of the simulation stations that we use. Okay, so now we're getting to the slides of assistive technology in terms of what's out there, what we use. Basically, the rule of thumb is keep it simple. We want to start out with basic mechanical stuff in terms of hand controls. We don't want to get too sophisticated because anytime you go to any type of an electronic design, something always can happen because now you're cutting into the electronics of the vehicle. So basically, we're trying to keep everything mechanical and leverage friendly in terms of using any type of driving adaptive equipment. So if your left arm, left leg is affected, we're going to need some type of steering device for the right hand and some type of remote turn signal lever. So the basic spinner knob would be on the steering wheel. This would be for right-handed. And this crossover here is coming from the turn signal that's mounted on the left-hand side of the dashboard. Because now they can't activate the left-hand turn signal because their left arm is impaired. So now we have a crossover to the right-hand side and obviously the spinner knob for the right hand. So they operate their steering with one hand and they can operate the turn blinker with the right hand. So this would be for a left-sided deficit. Right arm and left leg affected would be steering device for left hand, gear shift selector, and a left-footed accelerator. So once again, we're going back to a spinner knob. Left-footed gas pedal. It's a mechanical setup that is bolted to the floor. It's mounted on a quick disconnect. So you can see the left-footed gas pedal here, crossover bar to the gas pedal, and the brake is in the same position here. This has been classified as a most dangerous piece of adaptive equipment out there, believe it or not. The reason being is that some people have been driving with it for years and years, and they forget to tell a friend or a mechanic. I don't know if you heard of the accident, the terrible accident in Santa Cruz about 5 years ago, where a lady was on the wharf having dinner, and she had too much to drink. She had a left-footed gas pedal in her Cadillac, and she asked a friend to move the car. He got in it. He didn't realize. She didn't tell him the left-footed gas pedal was there. He put his left foot right on that gas pedal, full bore, and smashed into the rail and pinned I don't know how many people against the railing on the wharf.
Good thing no one was killed.
But a lot of vendors now are refusing to install this. Once again, it's a consumer education in terms of
educating people that, hey, there's a left-footed gas pedal, even though there's a quick disconnect, people forget. When you take it to a car wash, you take it to a mechanic, and it's there.
Okay, both legs affected. We're looking at hand controls, and once again, we're looking at some type of different steering wheel orthotic devices.
So when working with steering wheel orthotic devices with hand controls, you want your most functional arm on the steering wheel. You want your strongest arm on the steering wheel. A steering weight count, a steering wheel counterweight is about a half pound weight that's positioned opposite the orthotic device on the steering wheel. So someone that might have minimal amount of strength, when they're turning the wheel, that counterweight is going to pull them around and vice versa. I have some of the stuff here I can show you after the talk and pass it around in terms of the orthotic devices. And we attempt to keep the orthotic device at the 8 o'clock or 5 o'clock position on the steering wheel, depending on what side the hand control is on. So once again, this would be a picture of a... Let me back up just a bit here. Okay, so we're looking at just a basic orthotic device of a spinner knob mounted on the right side. We're looking at a palm grip now. So this would be someone that doesn't have any grip, is able to slip their hand into a palm and out and into that platform and rotate around the steering wheel. This is your typical tri-pin for a quad. If it doesn't have any wrist control, they would be able to place their wrist in here and their hand would go around the peg here. There's been discussions on the National Traffic Safety Administration in terms of this guy, what would happen to the airbag deployed, how much of this is sticking out in the way of the airbags. So there's plenty of discussion going on now in the National Traffic Safety Association in terms of how to make this a little bit safer in terms of cutting down maybe the area surface of this for the airbag to deploy. We have what's called a basic C-cuff. And once again, all this harkens back to what Mark and I would see in terms of our clinical evaluation and a behind-the-wheel drive around the hospital grounds or a residential area. Okay, now we're getting into hand controls. Mentioned before, mechanical hand controls, we want to keep it simple. We want to keep just rods and pulleys in terms of just a straight shaft hooking up to the brake and the gas. The three style of popular hand controls will be a push right angle, push twist, a push pull. And now we're going to be getting to high-tech servo controls. There'll be gas brake, which is computer generated, which is really driving by wire. And then we have pneumatic hand controls, which are operated by air. This is just a slide of a push right angle hand control. You can see all the rods going down to the brake and the gas. It has a pivot point here. In this particular hand control, you're pushing for brake and down into the lap for gas. This particular vehicle has what's called a steering wheel column extension on it because this particular veteran was a wheelchair driver and we couldn't get him in close enough to the steering wheel, so we had to extend the steering wheel out 3 inches to place him in the optimum driving position. This would be a push right angle hand control again, but this is designed for a quadriplegic. You can see the wrist support here, the foam grip on the top, some support on the top, and his hand is going around this bottom bar here. And once again, it's going to be a push-in for brake, down into your lap for gas, activation for the gas and brake. This would be a push-twist type of a hand control. So you're pushing in for brake, and you're twisting like a motorcycle grip for gas. It's kind of a fatiguing type of a hand control. We really haven't prescribed that much in the past. The reason this type of hand control would be used is that if you have limited knee clearance to activate the gas on a push right angle, when you're bringing the gas down into your lap, the knee could act as a governor and just kind of get in your way and you wouldn't be going very fast. This is another picture of a push twist type of a hand control. And finally, we just got the basic push-pull hand control. So you're pushing in for brake, pulling back for gas. Okay, this is a new system that just came out of Europe. It's been here for maybe maybe 3 or 4 years now. It's called the Kempf Accelerator Ring, and it's a digital ring that you press down for gas. Is independent of the steering wheel, so that spins around by itself. The steering wheel would spin by itself, and so you're activating the gas with your thumb. So someone with pretty good finger dexterity could operate this accelerator ring. The brake is on the right-hand side. The advantage, so-called advantage to this style of hand control is that you're able to keep both hands on the steering wheel, which some people really like. Once again, but you have to activate the brake, a mechanical brake lever, by pulling down on the brake lever. This piece of equipment costs around $12,000 just for digital hand control. Mechanical hand controls that I showed you in the previous slides run about $1,500. So once again, don't know the track record of this particular hand control because it hasn't been out there for a long time. But so far, they really haven't too many problems with it.
Even though it's Toyota?
There you go. You never know. It could be a recall on it, huh?
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
Oh, no. Okay, now we're getting into the pneumatic types of hand controls. These hand controls run in the ballpark of about 20 to 25 grand. It's an air touch hand control. It's designed primarily for a quadriplegic. You push forward for gas, pull back for brake. It's, as I say, a pneumatic hand control. You have an air compressor in the back of the van that recycles the air through to give you enough pressure for activation of the gas brake. It sounds like a Greyhound bus, you know, air brake sound every once in a while, so this is going to be loud, but it's a pretty good hand control. The biggest thing on this hand control, it has to be serviced in terms of making sure that you're getting all the air or all the moisture residue out of the compressor, because that could be an issue. Activation of the secondary controls. So if you wanted to operate turn blinkers from this by using pronation and supination of the left wrist, you can activate all secondary controls of turn blinkers, cruise control, windshield wipers, and cruise control, windshield wipers, and actually window control too. On this particular setup here. This is another style hand control. It's called an EGB, electronic gas brake. It's drive-by-wire. It's made by a company called EMC. This control costs 26 grand. You can put all different types of orthotic devices on the termination here in terms of it can be a quad tri-pin or it could be an L handle just like what it is here. Secondary controls can be controlled on this particular hand control with a button right there. So if someone has finger dexterity, they can use an index finger or even a thumb to activate secondary controls, turn blinkers, cruise control, and all the other secondary features while the van is being driven. This just gives you a shot of the nightmare underneath the dashboard that's going on when you're using electronic and pneumatic controls. So you can see the setup, what has to be done in terms of outfitting and just refabricating anything. They say an able body could drive with this vehicle with the gas and brake, but if you got big feet, you can have problems getting hung up on all the controls underneath this particular vehicle. Okay, steering systems. We're looking at factory steering systems. We're looking at a factory steering wheel, which is approximately 16 inches in diameter, anywhere from 15 to 16 inches in diameter. Typically, all the new vehicles out now have rack and pinion steering. They're all front-wheel drive vehicles, so they all have rack and pinion steering. So a ballpark figure for factory steering on a 16-inch wheel is about 40 inch-pounds of torque. They have the ability, vendors have the ability to reduce the effort of the steering to low-effort steering, which is going to reduce factory steering by about 50%. They can even go to what's called zero effort steering and reduce that effort by 90%. So if you have someone with really weak upper extremities that has a range of motion to go around the standard steering wheel, then we can go to these modifications here of reducing the effort of the steering to make it a little bit easier to steer with. And then we, believe it or not, even have foot snow. A person would drive with their foot. So this is just a picture of a standard steering wheel, as I mentioned before. This is what's called the counterweight. This would be the orthotic device. So someone who is using low-effort steering or zero-effort steering who is still having trouble bringing it over the top, meaning from the 11 o'clock to the 1 o'clock position, because typically some people would get stuck in this position, that counterweight would help them come over the top by rotating the wheel down for left or right-hand turns. And this is a picture of the foot steering. So basically, we got the steering wheel here, we got the shoe with the peg in it, and we got the gas and brake over here. I've done probably maybe three over the years that I've been doing this, and this has been primarily for a post-polio who has really, really weak upper extremities but still has pretty good lower extremities in terms of steering with their foot and gassing and braking. Okay, secondary controls. I mentioned those before in terms of how do we activate secondary controls when the vehicle is being driven. If you have one hand on the steering wheel, one hand in a hand control, how are you going to operate all your windshield wipers, your cruise control, your heater, climate controls? So this is what's called an 8-function button. It can be mounted basically anywhere in the vehicle. Typically, so for a left-handed hand control user, this could be mounted on the door. And if they have the ability to wing their elbow out, they can engage this blinker. And it's based on do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. So they hit it once, and maybe the left-hand turn blinker would come on. They hit it twice for do, re, a right-hand turn blinker would come on. Do, re, mi, maybe the horn would come on. So the vendor can program whatever sequence they want in this elbow-actuated control here to operate turn blinkers, windshield wipers, and all the other secondary controls while the van is being driven. This can be mounted anywhere. We mounted this, as I say, in the door for left elbows. We mounted them in the head for a special head control. They can be mounted for a knee activation. So this thing can be mounted basically anywhere in the vehicle where they have functional use of whatever extremity they're going to be using. This is an infrared spinner knob. So it's used for a person with one upper extremity that's steering, and it has switches on it. So he can operate, once again, all the functions that you need for secondary controls, horn, turn blinkers, and keeping his hand on the wheel. If they can't operate those levers that I showed you before, crossing over, or maybe even the elbow-actuated turn blinkers with your elbow. So this sits on the steering wheel and has the buttons to activate the secondary controls.
Is that wireless?
What's that? It's wireless. Yeah. Yep. Works pretty good. Key use. If someone has decreased dexterity, then we can use key extenders. As you can see, it's double jointed, so we can break it in any type of joint. So as long as they're able to get the key in the ignition and use some type of leverage to turn the ignition to get it on, this is a real good solution instead of going high tech. Once again, it's simple. They're able to get the key in and turn the ignition on and off. Okay, so now we're going to a full-blown touchpad control. So someone that can't operate the key, can't use the gear shift selector, can't operate any of the dashboard controls. So we go to a complete touchpad configuration that will be mounted in the driver station that the driver can activate. So here we have all the gear shift selectors. We have an automatic start. The gear shift selector is here. We have climate control for everything on the dashboard. We have all the window mirror usage here. So everything that is mounted on the dashboard or a factory configuration is now mounted on a touchpad control. Okay, so now we're getting into our high-tech driving systems. Very, very expensive. But once again, fortunately at the VA does pay for a lot of adaptive equipment in terms of our vets. It's a very liberal type of a program where they're entitled to 2 vehicles within a 4-year period for the rest of their lives. So basically, if the medical conditions changes, we can go and update any type of driving adaptive equipment and also for any type of high-tech driving systems. High-tech driving systems, as I mentioned before, are very, very expensive. Just the driving adaptive equipment can run up to $100,000, not counting the van or modifications to a van. So now we're talking about van modifications and probably a wheelchair driver. Okay, this is a EMC driving system out of Houston, Texas. What we have here is the steering wheel is gone. So over here we have the steering wheel with an orthotic device on the steering wheel. We have the EGB, electronic gas brake, and we have all the touchpad controls that are needed to start, shift gears, and all secondary controls on this vehicle. The reason the steering wheel is gone is that we couldn't get the vet up close enough he was sitting too far, he was sitting too close, and all this equipment back here was just jamming him way too tightly, so we had to move him back. Disadvantage, obviously, is that you lose the airbag. So there are certain things that are trade-offs in terms of airbag is gone. If we want to remain a driver, then there are certain things that we have to do to take out the safety features of a factory vehicle. This looks like it was in a Toyota 2, I think. Maybe even a Honda. Okay, this is what's called a SCOT or DSI system. It's a mechanical pulley lever system. It's a unilever design, meaning you gas, brake, and steer all in one motion. This is what's called a forearm trough. This bar down here goes to the gas, brake, and steering. So basically, his hand is in a trough, his wrist is in a neutral position, and he's gassing and braking going forward and back, and steering is with pronation and supination only 90 degrees. So by turning his wrist just 90 degrees, you're getting full lock-to-lock on the steering. So it doesn't take very much to steer this vehicle. Disadvantage again, as you can see, no steering wheel, no airbag, all the touchpad configurations are in front. Here you see the wheelchair lockdown system, the automatic lockdown system that you would drive into, lockdown automatically and access everything in terms of the driver station. This is called the DSI or SCOT van, $100,000. This is the driver of the DSI van, so this gives you a better idea of his forearm position. Gas and brake is forward and back. Steering is with his wrist pronation and supination. Put actual head controls up here for turn blinkers. And you can see the fit of the wheelchair in the driver station. It gets kind of tight. This is a full-size Ford van, by the way. This is just another mini steering wheel that we can use in terms of the person's inability to use a factory steering wheel. We have mini steering wheel here with the touchpad controls on this particular side. So once again, you always want their most functional or strongest arm on the steering wheel, even though it might be a high-tech driving system with a small steering wheel range. Okay, now we're getting into driver stations, either going to be a wheelchair driver or a driver transfer. Just to give you an idea of a wheelchair driver and the driver station, the tight fit we're getting. As the wheelchairs are getting bigger and bigger now, the fit is getting really, really tight. And so it's really, really important to come up with a correct wheelchair prescription prior to even getting a van and modifying a van to make sure that wheelchair and the person in the wheelchair is going to fit in the driver station, because there's only so much vendors can do in terms of van modifications. This is an easy lockdown system for a driver, so everything is automatic. So he's going to drive into the driver's station. His wheelchair is going to be modified with a bolt, and that bolt is going to fit into this easy lockdown system electronically and lock him down while he's driving. Then obviously when he gets out, he hits a button, it releases him, and away they go. If the person has the ability to transfer, then we're going to do what's called a six-way driver transfer seat base. You can see the seat base comes away from the driver's station, from the steering wheel. It rotates 90 degrees. And a wheelchair would be positioned just next to the chair, and they would transfer directly into the driver's seat, swivel the seat around, and get back into the driver's station. And that wheelchair, unoccupied wheelchair, would be tied down for safety reasons in the event of a crash or an accident. There's other types of transferring devices. A lot of vets are going now to trucks or SUVs. If they're able to transfer, this is what's called a transfer platform. So basically, it would come down to ground level. The wheelchair would be here. The person would transfer to this platform. It would pick them up automatically. And then they would just transfer or slide directly into the driver's station. So that's another piece of equipment that we can use if someone wants to get, as I say, a truck or an SUV. They don't want a sedan. Or if they don't want a van and they show us that they can transfer safely using this piece of adaptive equipment. This is what's called a tourney seat. This happens to be on the passenger side, but they make them for the driver's side. So once again, this could be used for basically almost any type of application, van, truck, sedan. So if someone is having a little bit of difficulty transferring, this seat will rotate out, come out. The wheelchair would be here. They would transfer directly to the seat, pick them up, swivel, and put them back in either the driver or the passenger station. Okay, now we're getting into van modifications. Looking at van modifications for wheelchair drivers or just for anyone getting in and out of a vehicle, which is called safe vehicle ingress, egress. So we're looking at drop floors, raised roofs, automatic door openers. There has to be gas tank modifications, body raises, and dry shaft modifications. Federal government is really getting heavy into this area now because you can imagine if you're buying a brand new car or a brand new van that's been crash tested, and you take it to a vendor, a chop shop, and they're going to do all this stuff to it. What's that going to do to the structural integrity of the vehicle if you get in an accident? Particularly if you're moving the gas tank. Gas tanks are typically in the middle of the vehicle, but now with the modifications, are moving them to the rear past the axle. So what happens in a rear accident? That gas tank is exposed. So now the federal government has come up with really strict regulations on how these vendors can do all this in terms of changing air conditioning lines, in terms of changing gas lines. All the electrical components are being changed when they do these modifications. This just gives you an idea of a nightmare of a wiring nightmare of what's happening inside of a full-size Ford van. You can see some of the, this is a hand control over here. This is kind of hanging out over here, and they're trying to complete the wiring for it. So you can imagine you buy a brand new van for 30 grand, you take it into a shop, and it ends up like this for a few weeks while they're doing all the basic modifications to it. Yes.
But newer cars with more like drive-by-wire steering, drive-by-wire steering standard, is it significantly easier to make modifications to those vehicles?
No, it's not. It's an electrical nightmare now.
With
all the new vehicles now with the wiring harnesses.
Yeah.
The older vehicles in the old days, when before they came out with the wiring harnesses, a vendor could just tap into one wire and just come off that one wire. So if you wanted to, say, move the headlight switch from the dashboard to a toggle switch where the driver could reach for, the vendor could just tap into that, run a wire, secondary wire, solder it to a toggle switch. Now they can't do it. Everything's on a harness. So all these harnesses have to be broken down. So this just gives you an idea of a finished product of a floor drop. You can see the floor drop here. This is a 9-inch floor drop. So once again, that gives you vertical height. And then these two seats, a driver and passenger seat, you can see are on wheels, so they can come out easily. A wheelchair driver can fit up in that station. Or if it's for a passenger vehicle, this seat can come out and the passenger can ride in his wheelchair in the passenger station. Obviously, you want to take full advantage of all the safety features that a vehicle offers. So by having a wheelchair passenger in that passenger station, they can use the airbags or the air curtains in case something should happen in the event of an accident. So this is, you know, the issue of a drop floor, what it takes for a drop floor in terms of factory height. From here, it's been dropped down to this area here. So you can just imagine the engineering and the fabrication that takes into doing a modification like that. Okay, now we're looking at lifts with full-size vans. We've got rear mount, double post lifts. We have all different kinds of lifts that we can use. Once again, that's going to be determined on the wheelchair, the weight of the wheelchair, the weight of the veteran sitting in that wheelchair, what the capacity is that wheelchair lift is going to be. This is a rear-mounted platform lift. This was a real neat application. This is a 54-panel wagon Ford, and the veteran owned this vehicle, and he wanted to drive it, so the VA outfitted him with a lift and driving adaptive equipment for this. So it worked out really nicely for him. So this is a double-post lift. It can handle a lot of weight. This is just the side of a full-size Ford van with a raised roof. This is what's called an under-vehicle lift. The whole lift is underneath the vehicle. Advantage to a UVL lift, which this is that you have maximum interior room. There's no hardware on the inside of the vehicle. So this lift goes in a cassette underneath the vehicle, and it's out of sight. Advantage to this lift, once again, it gives you maximum interior room as the wheelchairs are getting heavier and heavier. They're getting longer. This can accommodate up to 900 pounds in terms of lifting capacity. It's a pretty good lift. Disadvantage, you can see the ground clearance. So if someone runs up on a curb, that cassette could get destroyed. This is a full platform, double post lift, and you can see it's just total blockage in terms of access in or out of that van. So in an emergency, it'd be very, very hard to get someone out of that vehicle if an accident were to occur with this lift blocking the entire doorway. It's a good lift, it's a good heavy lift, but once again, there's other applications that we can do. Then it has the automatic door openers here on the side. This is a single post lift. It has just one post. It's mounted on the rear end on the inside of this. The advantage to this style lift is that it's a tri-fold lift, so it folds when it's all the way up, so it gives you access in and out of the van. Disadvantage, as you can imagine, multiple usage with one post, it's going to start to tweak to one side if the wheelchair is any heavier. So this is primarily used for a lighter weight wheelchair or even a manual chair. And this gives you another single post lift. There's the mounting bracket, and you can see the floor drop. Okay, the big product now, the big market now are the minivan conversions. Chrysler products, Toyota Sienna, GM products, Honda Odyssey. These are manufactured back in major plants, either back in Indiana or in Arizona. They go through a regular big production line where they're torn apart and reconfigured. In terms of their modification. We have one of the major players for a minivan conversion is Braun. They also have an under-vehicle lift or an in-floor lift that goes into the vehicle. The biggest thing about minivans that Mark and I have to be careful of is the angle of this ramp. Typically, their angle of the ramp is about... The van kneels down. So when you hit a switch... The actual whole van kneels down, and what that does is it decreases the angle of the ramp. So someone who's in a manual wheelchair, they have to demonstrate to us that they're able to push up this ramp without any issues. So this gives you another shot of the minivan conversion, rear mount, side mount. Typically, the platform length on this particular guy is going to be about 52 inches. You just have to be careful parking against the curb on a high curb because the ground effects can get in the way and scrape up the ground effects along with the lift. As I say, these are a very, very popular vehicle now in terms of just being smaller in size, obviously, but getting better gas mileage, and you're able to garage the vehicles more easily than a full-size Ford van. And finally, we get to scooter lifts. Scooter lifts are just the basic terms of loading scooters. The VA gives out a lot of scooters to our vets. And so typically they're going to be on a sedan mounted or an SUV mounted. This particular one is actually a manual wheelchair carrier. It's mounted on the top of the sedan. Aesthetically, it's not very pleasing, but it does do a pretty good job. It only works with a full folding wheelchair. So you hit a switch, the person is able to transfer in the vehicle. This whole thing comes out. A chain comes down with a bar. You hook the bar over the seat of the wheelchair, you reverse everything. And the weight of the chair as it's going up, it folds itself. It comes up, it lays itself down on the side and closes back up. So that's an alternative to someone that can't afford, you know, a full-size van or a minivan that is still able to transfer and they don't want to buy another vehicle. So this would be a good solution here. They even make camper shell top carriers that are hydraulic. It's not a very good picture, but here we have a scooter lift that would pick up a scooter, put it in the bed of the pickup truck, and the camper shell would come down and cover the scooter or the wheelchair. This would be typically used, you know, in snow or maybe up north where there's a lot of rain. These things, you just have to be careful. You can't park in the wind. Because a good gust of wind hitting that guy will blow it off. And just another application of a scooter lift, rear-mounted scooter lift that would go in back of the vehicle. Rear-mounted scooter lifts. Okay, this I was hoping to have today, but apparently it's raining and I don't think the vendor is going to bring it out. But this is a new design. It's a motorcycle. Obviously, it's a BMW designed for a paraplegic to drive. In the back, there's a back ramp that comes down. He drives his wheelchair up into the compartment, locks down, and off he goes. And I was hoping to have that out today, but it's raining out. The vendor wussed out on me. He didn't want to drive it in the rain. Any questions? $45,000.
Ed, when he provides a van.
The vet owns the van. VA supposedly owns the adapter equipment, but it's the veterans. So if they go to sell the vehicle, the VA is not going to get any reimbursement back for any of the modifications or driving the adaptive equipment. It's a pretty liberal program.
It's up to the veteran to provide their own insurance to cover damage.
Okay, if the veteran is service-connected, and he qualifies for what's called the VA auto grant. And qualifying for the auto grant means you have to have service connection for loss of use. The VA will provide them with a one-time auto grant of $11,000 towards the purchase of a vehicle. The VA will pay for all major modifications and any driving adapted equipment that Mark and I prescribe. They're entitled to two vehicles within a four-year period for the rest of their lives. Insurance. So if I'm a vet on a 4502 and I go out and crash my van with a high-tech driving system, I don't need insurance on the high-tech driving system because I know the VA is going to pay for it. I'm just getting insurance on my van. It's a pretty liberal program.
The VA does not buy the system. So it's up to the veteran to buy the vehicle and then the modifications that the VA takes.
Yeah. Any questions about anything or comments?
Yeah, I'm wondering, like the driver training program assessment, you know, when it comes time to for that particular vet in a particular state, still in the middle of the process, you train them, you get them assessed.
They're going to need either a valid license or a permit from their state.
For you to.
Right.
Okay.
in order for us to take them on the road. Now, as I mentioned before, we're getting a lot of military coming back, and so they're stationed all over the country for their rehab at Palo Alto. So a lot of them will have a military license or licenses in Colorado, or the licenses still might be in Iraq. You know.
Thanks so much for that really comprehensive presentation.
Good. So I don't know if you wanted to go out and take a look at the van. I brought the Val van. We can go and take a look at it if you like. As I said, I was hoping to have the bike here, but that's not going to happen. So.
We're ready to have the bike here another day, maybe.
Yeah, a nice day.
Yeah.
We can all go for a ride.
Now sit right down.
Yeah, it's
5
the parking lot with the trailers. Right. Yeah.
I have handouts here on websites or vendors and manufacturers if you just want to.